Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a Rye report on the Conservative Conclave, CPAC, that just concluded in Washington with a keynote speech last night by Sarah Palin. Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief Adele Stan joins us. She has an article at Alternet, Occupy Protesters Mic Check Palin During CPAC Speech. We will discuss the civil war within Republican ranks as Mitt Romney desperately defends his conservative credentials while Rick Santorum assails the party establishment for backing a moderate. Then Mary Duziak joins us in studio. She is a professor of law, history, and political science at the University of Southern California and the author of a new book just out, War Time, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Since the United States has been engaged in constant arms conflict for over a century and has a permanent war economy, Mary Duziak's inventive meditation on war, time, and the law offers a welcome and important insight into our politics of war. Then finally, we'll be joined by Thomas Frank, the author of the new book, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right, which examines how the worst economy since the 1930s that crashed under George W. Bush brought about a revival of conservatism. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief and also writes for the AFL-CIO Now blog. Her latest article at Alternet is Occupy Protesters Mic Check Palin During CPAC Speech. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And describe, if you will, what happened with Sarah Palin's keynote speech. There apparently a handful of Occupy protesters who actually had to pay to get in got in there and did a mic check.
They did. They did a mic check. Sarah Palin was just about to launch into her diatribe against President Barack Obama. And they mic checked her, but there was only, you know, a smallish throng of them, 25 or so, probably fewer, amid an audience of some 4,000. So they do their mic check, you know, which is a call and response. A leader shouts mic check, and the followers, well, they wouldn't describe themselves that way, but their allies respond mic check. And before they could even issue whatever statement they were about to make, the entire room, thousands of people, start chanting in unison, USA, USA. And the sense of rage among the audience was really palpable, to the point where the police who were escorting the occupiers out seemed to be acting more as protectors than
evictors.
Yes, exactly.
So apparently the occupiers on the outside at the Marriott Hotel, which, by the way, is a Mormon company, just a little factoid there, they were apparently shouting, racist, sexist, anti-gay, right-wing bigots, go away. And that apparently infuriated Andrew Breitbart to the point where he started to scream at them. This video is available online. You freaks and animals, stop raping the people. A weird sexual reference from a conclave that was replete with sexual references and an undertone of sexual repression, at least to my mind.
Well, I think that's right. I think that's right. Ann Coulter notably addressed the conference with all manner of references to the sexuality of Democratic males, including references to ejaculations. And
yes, apparently Bill Clinton is sort of spraying his sperm hither and yon, right? I mean, they have to issue protective clothing whenever he's traveling or wherever he's showing up. I mean, that was her reference several times to it. And, of course, Rick Santorum is all about sexual repression, isn't he?
Yes, and you know, and beyond sexual repression, fecundity. You know, he does not believe in birth control. He did not say that from the CPAC stage, however, because you have in their midst a number of libertarians who have...
Well, he didn't have to, Adele. He had six kids standing behind him.
That's exactly right. And, you know, much of this Republican contest has had those sorts of visuals. And I did an article last week called Knocked Up, the Republican Plan for American Women. But, you know, back in the day when I was first covering the disputes within the Roman Catholic Church over birth control, abortion, all of these things, well, we used to refer to them, pardon me, as the pelvic issues. And I think that we have a Republican Party that is becoming increasingly more obsessed with the pelvic issues. And, you know, much of this is simply about, you know, maintaining power by the white men who have, you know, held power not only in this country but in the Republican Party for a very long time. And, you know, when you're talking about making birth control difficult for women to get, I mean, you're really talking about seizing power from women at the detriment of society. I mean, studies show that women who have control of their own fertility, the society itself is much more prosperous.
Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief, and she also has an article at Alternet, Occupy Protesters Mic Check Palin During CPAC Speech. And we're talking about the just-concluded CPAC event in Washington, D.C. that got unprecedented coverage this year. It was all over cable news. And Coulter's speech, again, just to reiterate the strong kind of sexual undertones of what she was saying, and I'm trying to figure out what the appeal is there amongst conservatives. She made the case, or the point, I guess, that the reason that the Democrats are in favor of birth control is because of Bill Clinton, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, and Anthony Weiner. So, go figure.
Yes, she's saying it's all just to serve their needs, never mind the needs of women. And of course, you know, what made this such a huge theme, not that it hasn't been quite an emerging theme throughout the campaign, but it was this past week the consternation over Health and Human Services rules that would have compelled institutions, including Roman Catholic institutions such as hospitals and universities, to, if they offer employee health care plans, include the coverage of health, of contraception in those plans. So that kind of fed a big theme that's been taking place in the GOP that's driven by the religious right, that Barack Obama is this sinister secularist who is making war on religion. Of course, that's a false accusation, but that is the fear-mongering that is underlying it.
Romney won the straw poll, and he seems to, but Santorum's speech was all about, you know, railing against the establishment for foisting a moderate on the party faithful. Sarah Palin, in her keynote speech, did make a reference to Romney in that regard. Our candidate must be someone who must instinctively turn right. It's too late to teach it or spin it at this point. But on the other hand, she called for unity. So, what's the mixed message there?
Well, indeed, mixed message would be the operative phrase. I think that what you see going on and what I felt was going on at CPAC, Ian, was that, you know, they're torn by these two competing notions, which is that they really want what they call true conservative, not somebody who is late to the cause like Romney and doesn't even quite get the language of the conservative movement. He referred to himself as having been a severely conservative governor. And, you know, we may look at conservatism as it's constituted now as really right-wing ideology and see severity, but that's not really how these folks see themselves. And so what's going on here is that they really would like a conservative or right-wing standard bearer. However, they really, 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 really want to beat Barack Obama. And they and their cause célèbre, of course, is the repeal of the health care reform law that was passed in 2010. So, you know, they know, I think they're beginning to come to the realization that a right-wing standard bearer such as, you know, as Rick Santorum would be, who's against birth control and who has made ridiculous statements about gay people, and he's not going to be, he's not going to play well in those suburban swing districts that one needs in order to win the presidency. So I think there's a sense that, well, Romney has swung around far enough to their positions that they can sort of hold their noses and vote for him. But interestingly, you know, concurrent with the straw poll, the American Conservative Union, which hosts that conference, did a national poll among conservatives, you know, self-defined conservatives. And in that poll, Romney was neck and neck with Santorum, as opposed to the straw poll, which, by the way, Rick Santorum accuses Romney of having bought.
Well, Ron Paul accuses Romney of having, and the main Republican Party, for having rigged the results in Romney's favor. He narrowly won in the caucuses there in Maine, where he won narrowly, but an important Ron Paul caucus in Washington apparently was snowed in or something and wasn't counted, and Paul still thinks that he will win at the end of the day. I don't know whether there's any shenanigans there. I mean, the Iowa thing was pretty suspicious, wasn't it, that Romney won and then it turned out he didn't win?
Well, you know, caucuses are funny things, and, you know, first of all, you're talking about these small-scale operations that are run by the local political party, so I imagine there probably is room for all sorts of things to happen, but honestly, we don't know. I mean, there really could be, because the vote counts are so close. I mean, Romney only edged out Ron Paul by yesterday's results by 190-something votes, I think 194. And if you do a second count of ballots, a lot of times in these caucuses, I don't know how Maine does it, but, you know, these are handwritten ballots and whatnot, you know, you wind up with a different result. So it's very hard to say whether it's shenanigans or just, you know, I mean, these folks who are doing these are, you know, they're not elections experts, they're amateurs. So it's very, very hard to know for sure. I mean, in Maine, you know, that caucus result is based on 6,000 votes. I mean, at CPAC, the poll, the CPAC straw poll, the one inside the room, I mean, was like 3,400 votes. So, you know, it's a very tiny contest.
Right. It's almost not much better than Dancing with the Stars, I guess.
Yeah, you definitely would have many more votes than Dancing with the Stars.
Well, that one's clearly rigged. I mean, I don't know whether you saw Sarah Palin's daughter flopping about on stage like a wounded seal, you know. But anyway, I digress. You witnessed some of the anger from not just Breitbart, from Dana Loesch, who's the editor of Breitbart's bigjournalism.com, the right-wing site that uses the word journalism rather recklessly and inaccurately. But anyway, they're making a anti-Occupy propaganda film, apparently, which is going to be distributed by Citizens United, the very group that brought about the Supreme Court change that's allowing super PACs and the wholesale buying of our elections by a handful of plutocrats. Nobody sees that as an irony, that these right-wing propagandists are making a film for the phony group that set up Citizens United. And by the way, the guy that runs Citizens United used to work for a congressman who's just quitting, who had conducted the hearings into Bill Clinton's friend Webb Hubble, the hapless would-be attorney general, whose prison conversations were taped. And this guy that's formed Citizens United manipulated the tapes to make what he was saying incriminating. And he eventually had to be fired from the House congressional staff for deceptive practices. And Breitbart's been involved with selectively editing transcripts and tapes in order to incriminate people. I guess, you know, who am I to judge? Nobody seems to care. Is that the problem?
I think that Citizens United is an organization that has flown under the radar of progressive scrutiny for some time, which is surprising given its role in, I mean, everybody talks about the Supreme Court decision that was decided in their favor and by the shorthand of the name of the group, but nobody seems to quite understand what the group is. And Citizens United is really a very powerful group, but the media that they produce, much of it is not media that you know, the general public sees. It's used as organizing material on the right. And, I mean, in the 2010 elections, I mean, they issued 3 feature-length films that were, you know, propaganda films that were used as organizing tools. They have a lot of money. These films are produced with very high production values. They commission original scores. They have spent as much as $600,000 on a single film. I mean, you know, Robert Greenwald of Brave New Films would just salivate to have that kind of money to produce a film. So they've escaped notice. And I suspect this piece of propaganda will be, really quite a thing. I think that, the director, Steve Bannon, who also directed the film about Sarah Palin called The Undefeated.
Did he do Hillary the movie as well, which was the original source of the Supreme Court case, Citizens United?
I don't know if he directed the film about Hillary Clinton, did he?
I don't know. That was the test case.
But that was a Citizens United case, yes.
Right.
But, you know, he was saying this is going to be crafted as a war film. That was what he was saying. That is exactly what he was saying. And they showed a trailer of it, and, of course, you know, they cherry-pick selective incidents that are really the actions of people who are not in concert with the Occupy message of nonviolence, you know.
Right, the black bloc types. And
right.
I'm sure they go out of their way to portray everybody that they only focus on people who haven't shaved and look like hippies, right?
Well, of course, and also the bad actors who infiltrated, you know, in Zuccotti Park, you know, people who are just sort of vagrants and criminals and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the focus will be. It won't be on the very, clean-cut college students who were the occupiers who disrupted Sarah Palin's speech.
who paid $60. Actually, they got a student discount, according to your article, Adele.
Yes, well, you know, we have to acknowledge, of course, that the right has tons more money available to it to advance its ideology than the left. However, you know, this is something that they do really, really well. And, you know, if I decided to go to CPAC, not as a journalist, but, to pay registration, the cheapest registration I would be able to get as an adult person would be $195. The kids, these college students, as long as they show a college ID, get in those 3 days for $35. So what they do is that these conferences are packed with young people, and they have a lot of activities for them and a lot of instruction on how to become journalists, on how to affect the political process.
And how to date.
And how to date, right? But you know, all of that is saying, I say this with admiration, that they are looking beyond the current generation always, you know. The right always takes a very long view, and I despair that the institutional left, you know, does not do the same, does not make the same level of investment. And I think that this is, you know, I have a dream of taking, you know, left-wing donors just through the exhibition hall of CPAC and saying, okay, like, this is what we're up against.
Well, Adele, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief, and she also writes for the AFL-CIO Now blog. Her latest article at Alternet is Occupy Protesters Mic Check Palin During CPAC Speech. And we're going to take a brief station break now and be back talking with the author of War Time.
A Catholic, the moment that came, because every sperm is sacred, every sperm is great. If a sperm is wasted, God gets quite irate.
Every sperm is sacred.
And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Mary Dudziak, who is the Judge Edward J. and Rui L. Guiardo Professor of Law, History, and Political Science at the University of Southern California Law School. Previously, she was a professor of law at Harvard University, Duke University, and the University of Maryland. Her books include Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey, and Cold War Civil Rights. Her latest book just out is War Time, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mary Dudziak.
Thanks so much. I'm so glad to be here.
And your book, of course, is not War Time, it's War Dot time, an idea, its history, its consequences. And it is a very welcome addition to analyze how we have been for almost over a century in a permanent state of war, and we also have arguably a permanent war economy. So tell me, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, the book basically came out of my frustration with how the concept of wartime works, both for people writing about war and writing about American society and politics, and also the way the concept of wartime works right now in American politics. So, you know, what do I mean by that? Wartime, the concept of wartime, it is sort of built into a way of thinking about, you know, war and peace, you know, with wartime always being followed by peacetime. And so we think of war as essentially, by definition, a temporary condition, because wars happen during wartimes. Wartimes are always followed by peacetime. That's the traditional way of thinking about it. Now, when you think about it that way, what you see in American political discourse is wartime itself becomes an argument. It becomes an argument justifying government action, because when someone says, well, why are we doing something like torturing people? And an answer is, well, it's wartime. Well, what does that mean? Wartime is a shorthand argument that basically means something really important is going on that the nation's very existence depends upon. And second, it's temporary. Right? Wartime is always followed by peacetime. Because it's temporary, essentially, don't worry about it. It's going to go away. It always does. So my effort here is just to problematize and think critically about what is this concept of wartime? How does it work in our thinking? And does it really fit the reality of American military engagement?
So If in fact, the presidential candidate, Ron Paul, often rails against the idea that we've been conducting what he considers illegal wars for the last 50-plus years. And he cites World War One and World War Two in as much as though there was a declaration of war according to the Constitution, the Congress gets to vote. And the executive branch just can't sort of slide us into wars under the table as they've been doing in the post-war era. And then you have, you know, the parades, the signing up in World War One. It was over there, and then at the end you have the homecoming, the ticker tape parades. So we haven't had one of those since 1945, right?
Well, let me start by saying with Ron Paul, it's been so shocking to me that the one candidate who ends up on some level making sense in terms of focusing critical attention on American war policy is Ron Paul. But anyway, you know, one point about, you know, how our political system works and the beginnings of wars. Now, legal scholars will now say, oh, we now have a different way of doing it. We have a different way that Congress participates. And for example, after 9/11, Congress passed an authorization, sure, for the use of military force. And most people think that's a functional equivalent of Congress declaring war. So there is a way that sometimes the Congress joins in and says, okay, yes, let's go fight this war in Afghanistan, you know, let's go fight this war in Iraq, when Congress essentially did sign on to Bush's war in Iraq. But one of the things that's been happening frequently is the country going to war without essentially calling upon the attention and the service of the American people. So I think that's the most important difference between the World War II era and, say, our contemporary war era. We do have some level of Congress participating, but we don't have the people in the war. And one of the things that happens when the American people aren't...
You meant the home front. Yeah.
Absolutely. And when we don't have the American people engaged in American war politics and thinking about the costs of war and actually experiencing the costs of war, we don't have any political pushback. And so we have these wars that drag on and on because we don't have the Vietnam War era experience where the American people essentially rose up and said, we've had enough. It's time to get out.
Because in part because there was conscription back in those days. There was the draft. So there was a direct connection between the citizenry and the war, in as much as young men were dying, and they weren't too happy about it. And there were a lot of young men who didn't want to go to that war. But if you contrast that, Meredith, with the Iraq War, that was one of the most cynical exercises. It was almost an immaculate war because it wasn't declared, apart from the fact that we were lied into the war. But that aside, an agreement was made with the press not to show dead Americans or dead Iraqi children or civilians. It wasn't paid for. It was off the books. Television networks even created themes as we built up to the war. It became a kind of narrative in the press, in many ways was the. The Israeli historian says it was the worst strategic mistake since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 9 AD.
Well, Iraq is a good example of where we've gotten to in, you know, what I think of as contemporary American war politics. And you're absolutely right that part of the absence of the American people from American war policy, by which I mean the absence of political engagement with American war policy, it's partly because, as you mentioned, there's no draft, right? So we've got an all-volunteer army. But there's a couple of other critical pieces to the puzzle. And one is the move to so much military contracting, so that in Vietnam, there was one contractor for every 16 troops. In Iraq and Afghanistan, there is a 1-to-1 ratio. So we've gone from 1 to 16 to 1 to 1. So many more of our jobs are outsourced, and that means we don't need as many American military personnel, you know, putting themselves on the line at risk, doing things even like making the soup. The other thing, and this goes to Iraq and how it's portrayed in the media, The other element of how the American people have gotten distanced from the cost of war is the way it's perceived and experienced now through technology that before we get to the drones, what we've got in Gulf War I under the first President Bush, the use of high-tech weapons, the smart bomb technology, is portrayal on television as if war is like a video game. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're not seeing dead soldiers. You know, we do see some graphic, horrible images of war, but the images sort of going into Iraq are of, you know, brave soldiers and high tech, mm-hmm. right? And so as Americans experience what war is as this high tech, precise game, and now Americans are even more isolated because a bomb can be dropped from a base in Arizona via a drone, right? We've got more distance between Americans and the costs of war, which then undermines the basis for any level of pushback politically.
And of course, the tragedy and the irony here, apart from that new aspect of the sanitized video game warfare, is just back to the Iraq example, is the extent to which the only people who end up bearing the brunt, because we have a volunteer or arguably a mercenary army, are the families, the military families. And you, in your book, Mary Duthiac, Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences, you mentioned the wonderful film, The Hurt Locker, and which the director happens to be a friend of mine, and it's, I think, a great piece of work that she did, and she, of course, got the Academy Award for it. The way that the guy has no place in after he's gone to the war. He comes home and the home life is so disconnected, and he's cleaning the drains and the roof, and you can see the total disconnect between what he's experienced and what is going on in the home front. And then he eventually goes back because he doesn't have any way to relate anymore. I mean, that's not an isolated case, by the way. That's fairly common, apparently.
Absolutely. And I'd say that anthropologists, Catherine Lutz in particular, have done really important work on American-based communities. And so what you see is it's not that all Americans are distanced from American war. It's that it's isolated and the burdens fall on particular communities and particular families. So what we have is basically we've created a warrior class, we've created warrior communities, and the rest of us are told post 9/11, go shopping. You know, and so I think that helps to produce the kind of political climate we have where, you know, even a fabulous, you know, new movement like Occupy is focusing on internal American problems and the economy and, you know, not marching against American war deployments.
Or you could be on the other foot. You could be marching for. If it was a declared war, the arguments were made, the national interest was involved, then we could have parades, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a pacifist. I don't think there's never a time when it's appropriate or important to use military force. But I think in a democracy and the way our democracy is supposed to work, you know, that we should have conditions that are so important that you're able to rally the American people. And if the president and American leaders can't rally the people, then you have a decision. It's not time to go to war.
Well, you know, we've gone from one permanent war, the Cold War, to another one, the War on Terror, almost without the, remember the peace dividend? What happened to that? Let me again introduce Mary Duthiac, who is professor of law, history, and political science at the University of Southern California Law School. Previously, she was a professor of law at Harvard University, Duke University, and the University of Maryland. Her books include Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey, and Cold War Civil Rights. And her latest book just out is War Time, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. And we are able to offer up this book of Mary's that's just out from Oxford University Press, Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. here as a gift for those who support Background Briefing here today at 818-985-5735. For a $75 donation to Background Briefing and KPFK, we will get you this book very, very quickly. Wartime, an idea, its history, its consequences. And we thank you, Mary, for your book, and we thank the publishers for allowing us to offer up this book, which is an important and vital meditation on wartime and the law. And it's a welcome and important insight into our politics of war. And go through that concept for us, will you? The extent to which we are in permanent war, we have a permanent war economy, and we have the permanent politics of war. Because, you know, on just to bring us up to the date, we are not yet at war with Iran. But if you watch the Republican candidates, you would think that we are. And if they have their way, we will be. They're stepping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran. And it's not inconceivable that sometime during the election there'll be some kind of a war, or perhaps, you know, the U.S. has not been able to get any kind of guarantee out of Netanyahu that the Israelis won't strike. Just recently, the Secretary of Defense, speaking to the Washington Post, said that there's a real concern that Israel will strike Iran in the spring. So we could have another war affecting our elections, as has happened on many times before. So, you know, try and, if you will, you know, unpack war from politics, or are they so entwined that we are in this? Is that another capture of our of war capturing another part of our culture?
Well, of course they're entwined, and my concern is really the way that they're entwined. But let me sort of let me note one other contemporary dynamic that's actually going to be, I think, under the radar screen. And that's, notice Panetta, Secretary Panetta, announced that we're going to have a drawdown in Afghanistan, so that combat in Afghanistan is supposed to be ending. But when that happens, watch Guantanamo, when detainees who were detained, quote, for the duration of hostilities don't get released, right? So we have basically a war that's justifying detention, but there's not going to be an ending to the wartime that's the focus of their detention, even though we're going to have troops drawn down in Afghanistan. And so it's essentially going to function sort of like the 2010, August, September 2010, quote, end of combat in Iraq, which no one remembers. Why? No one remembers except NBC News, you know, Rachel Maddow and company, because they were complicit in this media moment when troops just basically drove across the border and NBC reporters said, oh, gosh, this is so historic. And then troops said, well, wait a minute, if combat in Iraq has ended, am I still going to get a medal for what I'm doing here when I'm serving under fire? Am I still going to get my hostile fire pay? And the Army basically had to walk it back. And they had to walk it back and say, oh, combat in Iraq has ended, but combat conditions still persist. You know, so you still get your medals, et cetera. So I think what we're going to see in Afghanistan is the work is going to happen under the radar screen, which on some level is my concern, that the American people are encouraged to not pay attention. That leads to no effective political pushback. So what I'd love to do is sort of talk a little bit about historically, how do we get to this point?
And thank you for joining us, Mary.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Mary Duziak, who's a Judge Edward J. and Rui L. Guiardo Professor of Law, History, and Political Science at the University of Southern California Law School. Previously, she was a professor of law at Harvard University, Duke University, and the University of Maryland. Her books include Exporting American Dreams, Thurgood Marshall's African Journey, and Cold War Civil Rights. Her latest book just out is Wartime, An Idea, Its History, Its Consequences. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment. And we're joined in a moment by Thomas Frank, the author of Pity the Billionaires, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right.
war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
That's how we start the show. Eagle soar and oil flow. You didn't decide what you chose. We will pay back what they owe. Depends from who you stole. We cheer for the villains though. Hustling, bustling, hitting low. Motion is perpetual. We call drill to give and go. All you reap is what you sow. No, where are the controls? Mass of individuals consuming as ritual. You ain't hear them say ride slow. Dude, don't let them play us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Frank, a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, the founding editor of The Baffler, and a monthly columnist for Harper's. He's the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and his most recent book just out, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Frank.
How are you today, Ian?
Very well, thanks. And I'm so grateful that you could join us here. Does it surprise? I mean, it clearly surprises you, and it absolutely baffles me that at this moment in time, with what the Occupy movement has done to raise our collective consciousness about the dichotomy between the 99% and the 1%, doesn't it strike you as a little arrogant and hubristic on the part of the Republican establishment to put up a 1%er for president of the United States?
You mean Mitt Romney?
Mitt, right.
It is astonishing to me, and I think it's going to be tricky for a man like him to win this fall. For the idea of electing a quarter billionaire from I don't know if you call Bain Capital part of Wall Street, but it's something real close. You know, it's part of the financial industry. To put someone like that in the White House would be an extraordinary deed, but it would also really be in keeping with the sort of spirit of inversion that I talk about in Pity the Billionaire. That's everything is upside down these days, so I guess it probably shouldn't really surprise us.
Well, that's what's scary, though, the fact that it's upside down, the fact that there's so much angst and so much confusion out there, it could lead to his election as feckless and clumsy as he appears to be. And by the way, he is at Wall Street because he is the epitome of all that's wrong with Wall Street, which is the extraction model. Wall Street's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth, and that's what distinguishes him from the robber barons who built America into the economic giant, and private equity, which he's so skillful at, is totally about extraction. They don't bring anything to the table. They find these ailing businesses and literally strip them and loot them, and whatever success of business follows. Is shackled to paying off huge bank loans and huge payments to these guys like Mitt Romney, who in turn only pay 15% tax.
All true. And I would say, what's really interesting about that is the only person out there that has really made that critique in a public way has been, of all people, Newt Gingrich. I'm even wondering if Barack Obama and the Democrats will go there. I feel like it's sort of off limits to them, making that kind of critique, something that would have once been second nature or even obvious to Democrats.
Well, what has compromised Democrats to the point where they've allowed the narrative over the outrage on Wall Street to be captured by the right-wing Tea Party, which ends up being a kind of astroturf operation? The left left that on the table.
It's like a funhouse mirror. It's you said something really remarkable there, that this is the sort of central point of Pity the Billionaire, and I can't drive it home enough that this is the response to hard times, or this has been in the last 3 years, the main response to political response to the hard times that we're in has been this, you know, this shifting further and further to the right, the growth of this right wing movement, and they're, you know, what they the politics that they want to put in place are, you know, more of exactly the thing that got us to where we are in the first place. You know, more deregulation on Wall Street, let these guys do whatever they want, and they speak both of this kind of anger at Wall Street and this desire to cut the red tape, you know, and let banks do whatever they feel like. At the same time, these two ideas don't cancel one another out in their minds. It's very interesting.
But just in pure political terms, Thomas Frank, the thing that I don't understand, though, is that in pure political terms, now we're talking about, you know, the mechanics of politics, that what we started out talking about Mitt Romney being the poster boy for the one percenters, and what an insult that somebody like that is running at in these hard times. But then we made the qualification that he may actually get elected. And the reason he may get elected is that people are angry and confused, and you've got one in four households underwater in this country, meaning people owe more than their homes are worth. Yeah. And you've got an enormous number of people who've lost their homes. That is a very fertile field to tap, and I can't understand it. Why the Obama administration has not made that their central campaign theme. Instead, they've come up with this pathetic $25 billion bailout that is literally a drop in the bucket. Explain that.
Well, this is what the sort of second half of Pity the Billionaire is about, or the last third, I should say, about the failure of Democrats to grasp the situation that history presented them with in 2008. And, you know, truth be told, at the beginning, it sure looked like Obama was the man for the moment. I mean, that's certainly what I thought in 2008 when he was elected, and, you know, those enormous crowds when he was sworn in Washington. You know, it was like Franklin Roosevelt or something like that. And but he really let the opportunity slip through his fingers, and it's persistently his mistakes have been, you know, all in a pattern. And what it repeatedly comes down to is bipartisanship and his sort of fascination with the idea of transcending partisanship in Washington, which is, you know, at one level, you know, profoundly naive. You know, there's a reason that we have two different political parties in America. And then at the same time, I'm sure he doesn't think it's naive. I'm sure he thinks it's very hard-nosed and pragmatic. But it hasn't been that. It's been a disaster for the nation and for him politically. And he's changing his tune now, but it may be too little too late. I saw a story in Business Week the other day about President Obama's campaign manager going to New York City and meeting with a bunch of investment bankers and essentially telling them that, promising to them that Obama would not criticize Wall Street in the on the campaign trail, that was off the table this fall. And, you know, that's astonishing. To think that, you know, in the aftermath of five years of an economic slump, that he's not going to criticize the people responsible for it. I just don't get that. I mean, but we all know why. Money. You know, if Mitt Romney has taught us one thing, it's that you've got to have a whole lot of money in your super PAC in order to blast the other guy. You know, like, look what he did to Newt Gingrich. And then look what Newt Gingrich did back to him. This is a game of where only money matters. And
well, do you think though that there has to be an educational process being president of the United States? And you know, historians argue that the first term is when you make all the mistakes, and the second term is where you actually get something done before you become a lame duck, which happens pretty quickly. So it's in that context, I'm absolutely astounded why he would still have this bipartisan impulse, this post-partisan impulse, because my understanding is, and I'll just run this by you for your analysis, Thomas Frank, is that given the fratricides that are going on the Republican side and the fact that Romney is being diminished as a candidate by his own gaffes and by the constant assault that he's under, he's not likely to be emerge from this very strong. And it would seem to me that the best chance the Republicans have of winning would be a foreign policy disaster, which befell Jimmy Carter, for example. They haven't. The White House hasn't been able to get a guarantee out of the Israelis that they won't attack sometime in the spring, which the Secretary of Defense just recently went public and said that there was a likely prospect that that would happen. It would seem to me that if you look at what happened during the Vietnam War, where Humphrey's chances of getting elected were hurt by secret meetings with Henry Kissinger and Madam Chiang Kai-shek that managed to get the South Vietnamese to walk out of the peace talks and deny Humphrey the peace dividend, if you will, and Bill Casey's, Reagan's campaign manager, working with the Ayatollahs to keep the hostages in Iran while Jimmy Carter twists in the wind. These are examples of the opposite of bipartisanship, which actually has a definition known as treason. But given that Eric Cantor and the Republicans are so close to Netanyahu, I don't think it's a huge reach to say that this could happen. And so if Obama's political survival is on the line here, surely if there's any truth to what I'm speculating here, he ought to get real.
Yeah, but that seems like some an unlikely series of events to actually worry about. I mean, of course the Israelis might attack Iran, but its implications on for the American presidential contest are pretty far down the list. I think there are all sorts of things that can happen between now and November that might. That might change the outcome of the election, and one of them is almost certainly, I think far likelier scenario is what's happening in Europe right now with Greece. And if the Europeans manage to, and every indication shows they're going this way so far, if the Europeans manage to fling themselves off the economic cliff and plunge the world back into another recession, which they might do, they did it in the 30s, and they might do it again.
Right.
That would you'd see unemployment spiking back up, and I think it really wouldn't matter who the Republican nominee is; he would win.
Well, what I was suggesting is that at the very least, in that scenario, the Iran scenario is that gasoline would be, at September, October could be up to $6-7 a gallon, and that would be a difficult thing for anybody to run on. And after all, the president threatened to veto the National Defense Authorization Act, not because of its infringement on civil liberties, but because of his concern that it would push the Iranians back, with the sanctions on their central bank to the wall, and therefore raise the price of gasoline, and he wanted to have some wiggle room on that one.
Yeah.
So it's clearly something that they're thinking about.
You might be thinking about the price of gasoline. Absolutely. Yeah, that's always something to worry about. But this is something this is a subject I know a little bit about, not a whole lot. I'm not a great authority on it, and we always think that the supply of gasoline is, of course, related to events in the Middle East, and it is. But it's also related to, these days, it's related to speculation. Speculators, the price of oil rises and falls with essentially with the unemployment rate and with how fast people perceive the economy is recovering, and this is because it's driven by speculation. And it would be an easy thing for the president to, when you start looking into this publicly, when you have hearings about, about how this is happening, that's very helpful. And actually, this happened before. You remember in 2008, the price of gasoline went way, way, way up, and then all of a sudden it fell way, way, way down. This is this amazing bubble.
The Republican alchemy, yes.
Yeah, it was very strange. And nobody can really explain it. I mean, there's no real obvious explanation except for the speculators, and a bunch of speculators got ruined, and suddenly all their bets were working in the other direction. Anyhow, this is something that you could hold hearings on, and that would have the same effect as as bursting the bubble.
Well, I keep running these theories by you, Tom. but I did a forum recently at UCLA where I had two political pros who'd run, one of them had run John McCain's presidential campaign, and another one had run a whole bunch of Democratic presidential campaigns as well. And one of the things that they said that was fascinating was that in an election year, and we're going to spend record amounts this year, as we can see from thanks to Citizens United and these super PACs, that they only spend their money, the billions and billions of which, of course, all of which go to the media companies who get rich off our broken system, that most of the money goes to the swing states. They don't care about the other states. So we're only talking about maybe at the most a third of these states in the United States that they focus on. And then when it gets close to the elections in October, they concentrate on the undecided people who, if by October you are undecided after billions and billions have been spent haranguing you for months on end, you've got to be pretty stupid. And apparently the polls indicate that the swing voters are incredibly disengaged. They don't read. They don't care about anything much except, potato chips and beer. And all of that money and effort is going into the dumbest, least engaged demographic in the country, who at the end of the day decide our political fate.
That's so pessimistic. What a bleak vision.
Well, these were pros, though. I mean, these are guys that do that work. So I had to, take them seriously.
I'm not going to contradict you there. I'm just going to say that that's a very bleak way of looking at it. I'm pretty bleak. I'm a very pessimistic guy. But as far as I'll go down that road is to concentrate on the what fascinates me is the way the money translates pretty directly into votes. So, Romney spends X millions of dollars in Iowa, and it has, such and such result in the form of, blasting Newt Gingrich, to pieces. And then Newt lines up his billionaire and comes back and goes after Romney with, the criticism that we were talking about before, criticizing Bain Capital. And then Romney does, gets his billionaires going again and does the same thing back to him in Florida. It is fascinating, but it's just... at times, it just seems like it's a game of dollars translating into votes.
Well, Thomas Frank, I thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Frank, who's a former opinion columnist for The Wall Street Journal, the founding editor of The Baffler, and a monthly columnist for Harper's. He's the author of The Wrecking Crew, What's the Matter with Kansas, One Market Under God, and his most recent book just out, Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.